Yes.
There it is.
There we go. Alrighty, welcome everybody to the February 10th, 2016 session of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We got a lot of stuff that we've heard before that we're going to be working today. I will just note for those, we have an amendment that's coming in that actually came in late for Senate Bill 1547 that we have to wait an hour before we can deal with it. So we'll be taking that up probably last. We're going to start off with the work session items, and we will start off with Senate Bill 1510. I'll open a work session on 1510. Go ahead, move.
I would move Senate Bill 1510 to the Ways and Means with no recommendation.
We're going to deal with the amendments.
Yeah. We have to deal with the amendments.
This on the back side.
Yeah. Sorry, the script's off here. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1510.
Hey, Senator has moved the Dash 1 to 1510. Is there discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition to that motion? It's adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 1510.
Senator Gerard's moved the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 1510. Is there any discussion on that motion? There is none. You don't want to do the 4.
Yeah, okay. You hit the gavel because it's approved.
Okay, so we're now to the amended motion. Go for it.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1510 be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee with no recommendation.
Senator Girard has moved Senate Bill 1510 as amended by the Dash 1 and Dash 3 to Ways and Means with no recommendation. Is there discussion on that?
Sorry,
we really want to do with no recommendation?
I can do a due pass. I don't care.
What the due pass? Isn't that what you said?
Yeah, I'll amend it to a due pass.
With the due pass recommendation. Corrected that. Discussion on that motion. See no discussion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 1510 has amended by the Dash 1 and Dash 3s is moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. We'll close on 1510. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1521. That's the no recommendation to rules.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1521 be referred to the Rules Committee with no recommendation.
Senator Gerard's moved Senate Bill 1521 to rules with no recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 1521 is moved to rules with no recommendation. We'll close on that. We'll open on Senate Bill 1543.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1543.
Senator Gerard's moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1543. Discussion on that. Is there any opposition to the motion? Dash 1 is adopted. Senator Girard?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1543 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and rescind the Joint Ways and Means of Referral.
Senator Girard has moved Senate Bill 1543 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation and rescinding the referral to Joint Ways and Means. Discussion on that motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 1543 as amended by the Dash 1s is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and Senator Gerard will carry. Close on that. We'll open on Senate Bill 1572. Oh, I have to move that one. The chair moves the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 1572. Is there any opposition? There is none. The Dash 3s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 1572.
Senator Girard has moved the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 1572. Discussion. The chair will be objecting to that one. As I mentioned during my testimony a while ago, I think you can do that already under existing law, and we don't need that additional language. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I'm a no.
I would just like to say that we can't do this under existing law, and by doing it, it will really drive the rates down for the ratepayers, because hydro is probably the cleanest, greenest energy that we have, and this would just add it to the portfolio. I think this is extremely important, especially the hydrogen technology piece and for irrigation districts. So I would encourage a yes vote.
Okay. Any other comments?
A no vote.
All right, so I think we will call the roll on this one. The motion is to adopt the Dash 5 amendments. Please call the roll.
Senator Reilly?
No.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Chair Beyer?
No.
Vice Chair Fitzgerald?
Yes.
Senator Monroe?
No.
The Dash 5 has failed.
Patrick Hope.
And let's see, now we're going to, so we set it up for the minor report. So the chair moves Senate Bill 1583 as amended by the Dash 3s to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
Yeah, I'll be a no because we're going to do a minority report and bring the Dash 5s to the floor.
1572, I'm sorry, I pulled the wrong number.
We're good.
We all know we're talking about 1572.
Now we do. Solar bill.
Sorry about that. Okay, so we have a no, and I assume you're going to be a no as well.
Yes.
Let's call the roll one more time.
Okay. Senator Reilly?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair Girard?
No.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. Serve notice?
No, you have to hit the gavel.
Okay. Senate Bill 1572, as amended by the Dash 3, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass. I will carry.
Mr. Chair, I'm serving notice of a minority report.
Ditto.
Ditto.
Okay, that's all we need.
Okay, we've got notice on record.
Yeah.
All right, so we are closed on that. We will open on Senate Bill 1583.
Yes,
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 1583, the Dash 3 amendments.
Cool. Senator Girard has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1583. Discussion on the motion.
Colleagues, we've got agreement from all the parties, and this seems to work.
How unusual. Everybody's on board. Any discussion?
We don't need to see nods of heads and everything to verify? Or
you want people to
see? I see a few.
Okay.
Perfect. Okay, thank you.
Is there any opposition to the motion? Dash 3s are adopted. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair or Chair. I move Senate Bill 1583
as amended by the Dash 3 amendments
to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Girard has moved Senate Bill 1583 as amended by the Dash 3s to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. Senate Bill 1583, as amended by the Dash 3s, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. The chair will carry. We'll close on that. Okay, we got that out of the way.
Mr. Chair, if we might stand at ease for a moment, I'll make Senator Fairley come down.
Okay. We'll stand at ease a minute. We're waiting for Senator Farioli. The next bill we're going to take up is Senate Bill 1588. It's nice when everybody's agreeable.
You have an amendment.
I'll talk to them.
Yeah, it's not.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
We'll try that again. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1588. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will give you a rundown. Senate Bill 1588 allows rural counties with no population growth, as well as local governments in such counties, to adopt comprehensive land use plans without complying with statewide land use planning goals.
Senator Farioli, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senator Ted Farioli, District 30. All are part of 11 counties, 34,000 square miles. If you do the math, you'll find that the average population would have to grow about sixfold to reach the federal definition of frontier. So it starts in Marion and Clackamas County and then ends in the Idaho-Nevada border. I border on Washington, Idaho, and Nevada. I would have bordered on California, but they gave me all of Lake County except Lakeview. That's a cruel joke, but...
You've got a district bigger than a number of states.
Actually, several states put together. But the reason I'm here today, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for the hearing on Senate Bill 1588. Colleagues, you may recognize this bill. I've brought it before a committee in the Senate every session for the last three sessions. What it does is, well, let me tell you what some people characterize it as. The end of Western civilization as we know it. The destruction of Oregon's environment, the conversion of all available open space to industrialization, and, you know, just really a dagger pointed at the heart of the environment. That ain't what this bill is.
You forgot the sage grouse.
It'll kill, slag heaps and smokestacks. Colleagues, the land use laws in Oregon are well-loved and well-respected and well-protected, particularly because they protect our valuable, high-value farm and forest land. But I've got areas in the rural communities that have not had a population increase since the last decadal census. Matter of fact, they're losing population. So what happens is the local sawmill closes and the kids move out of the school district and the houses go vacant and the vacancy rate, you know, goes way up and people have foreclosure issues. And to try to attract new businesses to that environment is pretty tough. It's not all gloom and doom. We've got small class sizes, very kid-centered communities. Our kids score very high in terms of reading and math comprehensions. And they got cultural advantages. There's 4-H. There's VOAG. There's, you know, what we are now calling career technical education. They never lost that. So it's not all bad. But the local jurisdictions have huge, sometimes insurmountable challenges doing something like expanding the urban growth boundary. You know, in places where you've got a lot of depth on the bench administratively, it still takes 3 or 4 years just to draft the plan. And it's all subject to appeals by anybody who has a postage stamp. Although, folks, you know, I'm understanding that millennials can't vote because they don't have a postage stamp, but apparently they can't appeal. So they got a stamp for appeals. But at the end of the day, those small communities are having terrible difficulty just having opportunities to attract new or expanding job opportunities to sort of stabilize those communities. And, you know, I don't want to make too much of this. I will tell you that a lot of the angst that's happening over federal land control and the issues of self-determination could be ameliorated significantly if there were opportunities for home building, job creating, just any kind of expansion of the economic base there. And that seems to be very difficult, if not impossible. We know of cases where people have been engaged in the urban growth expansion discussion for almost 20 years. So that is one issue. Another issue is, you know, when the counties were required under Senate Bill 100 to do land use designations, they didn't have any problem doing that within their cities and towns because they knew, you know, by address and by type how to color those maps. But when it came to doing something outside of the small cities, they didn't have the money to do soil testing so they could categorize their land use inventory by soil map so that you could separate the really high value row crop ground from the scrubland and the uplands and so forth, where you may only get 9 or 10 inches of rain a year. You know, this isn't Willamette Valley vineyard land. This is sagebrush steppe. And so all that land defaulted into high-value farmland designation, EFU or, you know, grazing land. So those minimum parcel sizes, 160 and 240 acres, are part of the goals that communities would have to meet in order to allow an individual to go there and build. And even if you found somebody that wanted to build on 160 acres, they would have to build only in a structure that's appurtenant to their cattle or farming operation. So, you know, places that are really in need of a tax base to support the school districts and hospital district and public safety, which everybody relies on when they go visit. You know, if you get hurt, it's going to be volunteers that show up in the ambulance to save your life. All of that infrastructure is starving and falling apart, and it's not sustainable on the local base. Part of the solution to that would be to allow more flexibility in local land use laws. So what we've done is we've limited the scope of this bill that would allow rural counties with no population growth and other local governments in the county to adopt comprehensive land use plans that have an exemption from these LCDC goals, just as they do in Washington State. You know, this model's been very successful in Washington State. Eastern Washington, if you've ever done any traveling on the east side of Washington State, has a vibrant economy and a lot less trouble maintaining infrastructure and paying for public services because they have a tax base. So really, I guess what I'm asking for in a nutshell is for this committee to allow local jurisdictions the flexibility to create a new tax base that's not dependent on timber harvesting or cattle ranching, but dependent on, attracting new jobs or attracting people that want to live in that environment, maybe even for a second home. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll take any questions and be grateful for the opportunity to answer them.
Thank you. Questions?
I have one, since we have to waste a little time. Senator Roblin and I, or actually when we were in the House, we went to did a tour of rural Oregon, and I heard more than once about ranches and et cetera that the family couldn't stay together because of the land use laws that, for the kid to actually work the ranch, he had to, stay 40 miles away. I'm sure you've heard stories like that as well.
Right. So just the idea that you should be able to apply for and get a permit for a family member to build an additional home. The average ranch in Grant County is 4,500 acres, so you'd think that there'd be a place on that ranch that you could build an additional structure, but with our current land use laws, it's just not possible. But really what I'm referring to is most of the agriculture and the anchor ranches are in riparian areas, and then you've got this vast upland that's really not suitable for irrigated agriculture or cultivation, and it's just grazing mainly. A lot of that ground could in fact be used to support the local community if it was on the tax roll with a home and the appurtenance structures for a home. Folks worry about I've heard all the arguments about infrastructure and cost, and it's going to be the camel's nose under the tent to destroy Senate Bill 100. You know, local elected officials are still responsible to their electorate, and their electorate doesn't want to see damage to that ecosystem. They want it sustainable, but they're also trying to keep the hospital and the school open. So I'm going to say to you that, if you look at Wheeler County, for instance, one of the larger counties in eastern Oregon, there's only about 2,500 people living in Wheeler County. It is not a place where urban sprawl will or is a problem. It isn't a place where there's huge threats to the agricultural base by greedy Californians pouring in their hordes over the border, driving their, expeditions and staking out the land. We could use a little bit of development in rural eastern Oregon, and the only way it'll happen is if we get some relief along the lines that they've already discovered in Washington State.
So, Senator, which counties, do you happen to know which counties this would apply to now? Maybe Gillum, Sherman?
I've got a list that I'll provide to the committee.
Okay.
It's just, put it this way. Any county that's losing population is also a county in huge distress economically, and those are the ones that need to be helped.
I was trying to think that out. I assume it's not the three central Oregon counties.
No, it wouldn't be. Deschutes
is probably not like Umatilla and Morrow.
No, I think they're anything situated with access to I-84, I think, doesn't have a problem. But some of those interior counties are really in trouble.
Good.
Mr. Chairman, if you choose to take action on this bill with your committee, you will be making history. It will be very much appreciated by the citizens in those communities that deserve to be sustainable. Thank you.
Do you have a question? Thank you very much, Senator.
Actually, I got one comment.
Yes.
And this is kind of to the chair and the committee a little bit. Maybe you want to weigh in. It just seems to me that the land use laws, we've butted up against them in so many different places, and it's going to take a lot of intestinal fortitude. But I do think that as a committee, we need to revisit land use in the state of Oregon and regionalize it and incorporate some of these ideas, especially like in rural Oregon. I have rural communities that, have some nice growth would be really, really nice. At the same time, I think that the premise of protecting Class 1, 2, and 3 soils and protecting forest land, that's equally as important. We understand that. But I do think that somewhere down the road, this state has to address land use. And the problem that not just in Senator Farioli's district, but in Metro, is that it's driven the cost of housing up so high that now that you're having a problem with rentals, et cetera, the cost of rent, and that can, that's a sign of a poor land use system. So I feel very strongly that somebody needs to revisit the land use system, and that needs to be done in the long session. It just does.
And Mr. President, someday maybe, Mr. Senator Beyer. Senator Beyer, I don't want to rewrite Senate Bill 100. I don't want to do that. I don't want to get involved in something so incredibly complicated that we bog down with that discussion. What I'm trying to do is show you a sort of a solution that won't fit everybody based on a model that's working in a neighboring state. I think the folks in Washington are every bit as concerned about the quality of environment as the folks in Oregon are, but they found a way to help sustain some of those rural communities so that when folks from Western Oregon want to come and visit, there's some infrastructure for their health, peace, and safety to support their visit. That would help us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thompson.
Oh, thanks. Senator Farioli, yes. I heard a rumor. I was hoping you could verify this.
Yeah, uh-oh.
Due to, the regulations in our state,
yes.
The recent things like paid sick leave and maybe the minimum wage bill that's coming up, I understand that Fruitland, Idaho, is your fastest growing city. Is that correct?
Actually, the Treasure Valley, which is located just across the border, just across the Snake River from Ontario, is in fact benefiting tremendously from a variety of policies that we impose on citizens in Oregon.
Yeah. Did you?
It's not unlike Clark County, Washington, but those are a whole different set of issues. Let's stay focused on providing some opportunity for those counties that are losing population.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Honeycutt. I actually think there's merit in that idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of 1588. I think Senator Farioli did a good job of explaining the bill. The bill is patterned after Washington's Growth Management Act. Washington enacted their GMA, their Growth Management Act, in 1990. They had about 20 years, almost 20 years worth of experience seeing what Oregon was doing with Senate Bill 100 and how Oregon had struggled with the implementation of Senate Bill 100. And so in the Growth Management Act, and Washington is the only other state that has a somewhat of a statewide controlled system like we do here, we wouldn't be having this discussion in 48 other states. Washington created an opt-out provision for their small non-growing counties. The exact same criteria that Washington uses in their Growth Management Act are the criteria that you'll find in 1588. Washington has 39 counties. Of those 39 counties, 10 of those 39 have chosen the opt-out provisions of the Growth Management Act. And there's some in eastern Washington, and there's some on the Washington coast. It's kind of a weird hodgepodge map, but they're spread out. What you'll find from Washington, and we had a planning director from Washington on legislative days back just before the last session that came up, that had been a commissioner in a GMA county and now was a planning director in a non-GMA county right next to each other. And he said you can go from one county to the other and you wouldn't know. And these were in central Washington. You wouldn't know the difference between the two counties. The development's the same. And I think what you would find were this bill to pass, and the statistics bear this out, is that I'm not sure that you'd see a whole lot of difference 10 years from now with this bill than you would today. These counties that we're talking about, the eight counties that we're talking about, and they're Harney, Malheur, Baker, Wallowa, Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler. And I handed a letter from Wheeler County in support of the bill. The eight counties that we're talking about, six of the eight counties are smaller today than they were in 1950. So this is the anti-Willamette Valley issue. Those counties are trying to figure out how to manage the growth that's coming into those counties, which also happens to have the part of the state that has the best agricultural soils. These eight counties are trying to figure out how to stop dying. They're dying right now. They're smaller than they were in 19. Six of the eight counties are smaller than they were in 1950. Senator Farioli mentioned Wheeler County, said that Wheeler County had about 2,500 people. He's being overly optimistic. Wheeler County has 1,400 people. And they've lost 60% of their population since 1950. Sherman County's down 20%. Gilliam County's down 30%. The only two out of the eight counties that have grown since 1950 are Harney County, Burns, and Malheur County, Ontario, and the growth there has been negligible. All told, in the eight counties that we're talking about, 35,000 square miles, in those eight counties, in those 35,000 square miles, there are 73,000 people, okay, about two people per square mile. Medford, on 25 square miles, has 78,000 people. So there are more people in Medford than there are in those eight counties. Those eight counties represent 35,000 square miles, over a third of the state. Medford is on 25 square miles. And so it gives you a real flavor that these counties are truly, they're truly frontier counties. The growth, if you look at the growth prior to 1973 and then from 73 forward, what you'll find is that those counties weren't growing prior to, from 50 to 73, and they haven't been growing from 73 to 2016. So you can't say that, I don't think you could say that Senate Bill 100 has had an impact on whether they grow or whether they're growing or not. But what we can say is that if this bill were to pass, what this bill would do is it would give the county commissioners the ability to come up with their own comp plans and zoning ordinances. The bill doesn't say that in the eight counties it's a free-for-all, you can do anything you want. What the bill says is if the counties are not experiencing growth, then we let the counties create through their own comprehensive plans and their own zoning ordinances a growth pattern so that they can do it themselves. I've talked to the county judges. I mean, most of those counties, they're county judges and not chairs of the county commission. I've talked to the county judges in all eight of those counties. Those folks, if given the opportunity, would not go out and screw things up. We've got at least one former county commissioner sitting up here on the dais. It irritates me when I hear from folks that are opposed to this idea that we just can't trust the county officials, because that's what they're saying. And I can tell you, having talked to all eight of those, and we ought to have them in your committee, they're not going to screw things up if you give them some self-determination and self-control. Now, in the end, you're not going to see Intel building a new plant in Burns. You're not going to see Nike building a new factory in Vail. It's not going to happen because of the distance and the infrastructure and the lack of people, frankly. But at the same time, you might be able, the counties may, and the cities within those counties may be able to attract some industry if they can say to someone that came in, we'll get you, if you submit a permit, we'll get you up and running in 60 days. You'll be ready to go to break ground in 60 days. You can't do that right now under Oregon's land use planning system. You could do that if you if the counties had a little bit of self-control and the cities therein had a little bit of self-control. They could do that. And so what we're trying to do, and every session, you know, we trot out some bills to try and help Eastern Oregon. Last session it was the mining bill, House Bill 3089. What we're trying to do is figure out a way that we can create some family wage jobs over there, knock down the unemployment rates, which are always higher. They're always higher than they are in the valley. And in fact, the unemployment rates in southeastern Oregon are higher than the neighboring counties in Nevada. Exact same geography, exact same counties, exact same makeup, exact same distance from major metropolitan areas. But the unemployment rates are significantly higher. The percentage of families living below the above the poverty or below the poverty line are significantly higher. The median family wages in those counties is significantly lower. There, Harney County, for example, is just getting its rear end kicked by Humboldt County, which is its immediate neighbor to the south in Nevada. And the reason why is because in Humboldt County, they're mining. In Harney County, with the exact same geography, we're not mining. So let the counties have some freedom and choice to make some of these decisions that would otherwise that would otherwise be made in rural counties and the rest of the states in the union. Give them that opportunity. The bill provides that once the county starts to show some growth, then they have to opt back into the planning system. So then they'd have to, they can't get out and stay out forever. They can get out, have 10 years to try and grow. At the end of that time, when the next census comes along, if they've grown, then they have to opt back into the system. So all we're trying to do is give those counties a opportunity and a chance to do something. And the folks that are opposed to this bill, I would, you know, I don't know why it's why it always has to be Senator Farioli or Oregonians in Action or groups like that that are trying to kickstart Eastern Oregon, come up with ideas. Maybe there's some other ideas from folks around here. If they've got some ideas, I'll do everything I can to help. So, Mr. Chair, again, I really appreciate you giving this bill a hearing, and I hope if it doesn't move this session, I hope that we can get something done in 17.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Gerard?
Yeah, back to the tour that I took, there was just a tremendous amount of angst through all those counties. And for those people that in the audience, you can laugh if you want, but they really, the vast majority of people I talk to want to align themselves with Idaho. Have you found that to be somewhat true, too?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerard, I have. And I've also found a lot of folks that are upset at the notion, and again, I mentioned this earlier, that if we let their local elected officials have some decision-making authority, that they'd go out and screw everything up. It's really irritating to be told that you can't control your own destiny because you really don't know what you're doing. What we know is that the system we have for those eight counties, whether it's land use or transportation or economic development, whatever this, what we're doing as a state right now and at the federal level for those eight counties isn't working. So it's time that maybe we find something else. We keep bringing up ideas. Folks come in and say, well, that's not a good idea, but they don't offer an alternative. So if they've got alternatives, let's hear them, and maybe we can coalesce around a good idea.
Other questions? Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Peggy Lynch.
I'm counting on you to have those good ideas, Dave.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. And before I go any farther, I do want to respond to Mr. Honeycutt. One of the things that is a letter that is in Ways and Means is groundwater studies for Harney County. What we don't want is to have Harney County be another place where we have the same kind of crisis that we had in Umatilla County, where the groundwater was sucked up, and we're now trying to restore that groundwater. So one of the things that the League is supporting for sure is to get more groundwater studies in the greater Harney Basin, so that we can make sure that there is water and groundwater for the agricultural industry. Our letter is on OLIS, and you will see there a nexus or a connection in our letter to a December 2015 report from OSU on agriculture. Table 12 indicates that $8.191 billion in total sales in Oregon is associated with the direct sales of $5.72 billion from agricultural production in Oregon. In eastern Oregon, cattle, which is the number one agricultural product, is the industry in eastern Oregon. And that's why some of us fight to be sure that there are acreages for our cattle industry. I wish I had had a chance to ask Senator Perioli, but in a previous meeting, I heard that it takes 40 acres per cow. So that's why it takes a whole lot of acres in eastern Oregon to have the cattle industry. So another thing that the League has done is to support extending the Infrastructure Finance Authority loans from 20 years to 30 years so our small rural cities can afford to repair, upgrade, or expand their water and wastewater infrastructure. You will see under the findings on page one of this bill that it says that business development in rural counties does not necessarily require an urban level of services. But they do. They require water and sewer and other public utilities. And that's why we want to make sure that development happens in rural communities, because we think that's where they will get the best bang for their buck and the best bang for Oregon's buck. To respond to Senator Girard's concern about the change in Oregon's land use laws or the lack thereof, in 2013, this legislature passed House Bill 2253 and 2254. 2253 requires PSU's population forecasting unit to forecast population for counties and cities. With that process, there is very limited opportunity for citizens to appeal those numbers. That means that cities and counties in Oregon can move forward on if they need to have an urban growth boundary expansion because they have numbers for which they are not a land use decision, but a decision that can move forward. 2254 required what turned out to be at least an 18-month rulemaking to streamline the UGB process, and so that both small and large cities now have a more streamlined process, 14-year only land supply requirement, but the rules were just adopted in December, so we haven't seen an opportunity to see how that will affect the land use system. So I guess my point is that certainly we don't believe that this bill is the right bill for Oregon, but we do believe that we need to always change and grow, and we need to make sure that we find answers for all of Oregon. Thank you very much. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, comments, Senator Girard?
Yeah, where do you live?
I live in Corvallis, outside of Corvallis right now, but I'm a native Oregonian, and my relatives came on the 1842 wagon train. My My husband's grandparents are buried in Vail. Part of the problem or part of the reason that Ontario and Vail and that area looks to Idaho, besides the factors that perhaps you consider, is also the fact that they don't have Oregon television. They only get their TV, they get their information about their government from Boise.
Can you see why people in eastern Oregon in these counties don't want people like you making their decisions for them? It really is bothersome. And it's not just you, it's the people in Portland, but these are people that live in eastern Oregon. They've been there for generations. You got people that have families. The son can't build another house because the regulations are too strict. And yet people like you get in the way of decent legislation to help those people in eastern Oregon that are really, really suffering. And it really, I tell you, it really makes me irate.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, I have relatives and friends that live all over Oregon. A classmate of mine has a family with a large ranch in eastern Oregon, one that I can think of right off the top of my head. But my husband is also a native Oregonian, and we have friends and relatives all over the state. We do almost all of our recreating now that we no longer have to work in Oregon, all over Oregon. We respect and love Oregon. We are crushed by what's happening in Harney County, and I have written Judge Grasty, somebody that I think is a fantastic county commissioner, judge, and we're heartbroken by what's happening there, in part because what's happening there is going to hurt what was going forward in Burns as far as them moving forward and having a better economy in the Burns area. And now it will be really difficult to find people willing to come to Burns. The other another problem that is happening in eastern Oregon, and frankly in rural Oregon all over, is that many of our K-12 schools are going to four-day weeks. Now, I agree with Senator Ferrioli with the small class sizes. I graduated in a class of 11 kids. With the small class sizes, you can get a really good education, but the perception that there's only a four-day school week is not a good one for business. So I am not unaware of what's happening in eastern Oregon, and I respect your point of view. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Peggy. Anything else? Thank you very much.
You betcha.
Aaron.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, I am Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. And we support the concepts included in Senate Bill 1588, as many of our smaller rural communities have struggled under the weight of our statewide land use planning systems. As you know, our land use system requires cities to use population growth as the primary factor in determining whether they should grow their urban growth boundary, looking at their needs and other changes that a city might want to make when they're looking for opportunities to grow. And during the numerous trips I've taken out to our smaller cities out in eastern Oregon, the loudest complaint I hear is about how the land use system is impeding their decision making at the local level. They work hard to find the resources within the lands that they have, within the budgets that they currently have. They do consult with the Department of Land Conservation and Development and try to find partnerships to find ways to find solutions. And they ask other cities about how they've accomplished the small economic developments that they have and how they can best proceed. And usually those comments come down to what consultant is the best for you to hire to get this accomplished, because their local staffs aren't as large and can't necessarily be land use experts as well as administrative experts and all of those things. So the task of complying with the land use system becomes very expensive. For example, this past fall, I was out on a tour of two of our small city regions that are located in eastern Oregon, and I was speaking with the city manager from the city of Seneca, which has a population of 200. And he was looking for a solution to a land use problem he was having related to a little bit of housing development. There are a few lots that are currently available within the city's UGB that are designated for residential growth, but they're owned by property owners who aren't currently interested in building a house on those pieces of property. However, the city owns a large swath of land that, when they did their comprehensive plan back in the 80s, was designated for industrial purposes. So their solution to the requests from the few families that have come in and said, you know, we'd like to stay here, we'd like to build our house here, can you find me a place to do that, was, well, we have the city land, maybe we should just rezone it. In talking to a number of individuals who are experts in these sorts of areas and are out there as assistants to our small cities, we're told they're looking at thousands, around 20,000, depending upon the method, of dollars that it would take in order to rezone less than 5 acres from industrial to residential because of the amount of process they'd have to go to show the need for new residential. We're looking, he was talking about building maybe 5 homes. That price tag does not come with the property taxes to support it. And that overregulation seems to not allow the local community to solve the problem when they have folks coming in the door saying, I want to be here, I want to stay here, and they're having to say, well, we can't because of the land use rules. One thing that Ms. Lynch mentioned was House Bill 2254, which was passed in 2013. The key to that bill was that it is based on population growth and population growth alone. The communities that this bill is addressing are the ones that show zero population growth. And therefore, no matter how successful that system is for streamlining it for some of our cities, it will not solve the problem for these rural communities that are looking for a chance to survive. In addition, I don't believe that this bill will result in a significant change in the relationship between the natural resource industries and the local government policies on land use. The local officials that work and live in these communities are aware of the decisions that they make having significant impacts on their economies. The county officials that work so hard to find a way to make the land use system work to avoid impacts on sage-grouse are unlikely to want to undo that collaborative process and end up with a listing of the sage-grouse. But where a county or city is seeing residents slowly pick up and move because of the inflexibility of the land use system, preventing creative local planning solutions to bring in appropriate industries to the local economy, we think we need more local control of that system. The land use system was put in place to manage growth in the state of Oregon, not to prevent growth in the state of Oregon. It was specifically directed at issues of uncontrolled development and local communities maybe saying yes to every developer who showed up, but I don't believe that is the problem that rural Oregon is facing. For some of our communities, the restrictions have not limited growth, but prevented it. In the ongoing discussions on how to provide meaningful impacts and policies to our rural communities, this bill is a great place to start to see where the state policies could be currently impeding local solutions. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions, Aaron?
Thank you.
That's all that I have on this. Is there anybody else who wishes to address the bill? If not, I think there's a lot here that we need to focus on. I don't think we're going to get it out this session. But one of the things that I would like to do, and I've expressed to others, is try to take this and some other land use issues up in the interim and see if we can deal with some of this stuff. It's pretty clear that we made some progress in 13, I guess it was, when we did that, but it's still very expensive to operate the system, and I'm not sure it makes sense. I remember back in 1973 when Senate Bill 100 was passed, one of my mentors who had been, he's one of the land use gurus in the state, thought that the state made a mistake by extending it outside of the Willamette Valley. Thought there was no reason to do it east of the mountains. So that still rings in my ears a little bit. All right, so with that, if there's nothing else, we will close on Senate Bill 1588, and we open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1547. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1547 clarifies that the term public utility does not include people's utility districts or electric cooperatives for the purpose of regulation by the Oregon Public Utility Commission. We have received statements of no fiscal impact and no revenue impact on the measure. We have also placed on OLIS a -1 amendment, which we can, the committee cannot vote on until 206, but can discuss before that. And for the purposes of, if the committee decides to move that bill today, we can suspend the rule that requires us to have the fiscal and revenue impacts on the Dash One Amendment.
With that, Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed the Vice Chair saw I was going to speak, and he darted out of here. Mr. Chair, I'm here today. My name is Alan Olson. I'm Senator representing Senate District 20. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 1547. And I'll give you a little background, and then we'll pass this off to the smarter folks than I. This bill is very reminiscent of a Rolls-Royce. It's a very good, quality, solid-built bill, and I'm the hood ornament. I was asked to be involved with this bill because of my commitment to my energy commission and my energy group, and it came forward that there were some problems with the definitions. Mark Meyer had some concerns and said it's a good time to put together a bill that would move this issue forward. And I want to thank everybody that worked on this bill, thank them for the concerned debate that we had, and we have reached a consensus that I think that will make this a better bill for the whole state. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove representing Umatilla Electric Company, and we worked with the senator on this bill. I'm going to speak to the Dash One Amendment, which takes a bill that has a few words, including a few extra ones that LC did to clean up some bad grammar, and moves it down into a bill that just has one sentence. And that one sentence does exactly the same in our view as the original bill did, but it does it in words that are more comforting to some people. And I really want to thank Senator Olson for taking the time to work through many long hours of discussions over this issue where we tried to address everybody's concerns, and I think we finally succeeded in doing so. The issue comes up because, as I understand it, the statutes 757, Chapter 757, that deal with the Public Utility Commission, as Mr. Chair, you well know, predate the codification of Oregon's revised statutes. They're well before 53. When I've been discussing this with Mark Meyer, he thinks they may date back into the 30s. And obviously, when definitions are set back then, they might not reflect what's happening now. And back then, there weren't PUDs, and I'm not even sure there were co-op electrics, but in any case, the Public Utility Commission has always had jurisdiction over investor-owned utilities, but not those publicly owned utilities, either PUDs, municipal utilities, or rural electric co-ops, except for certain specified things like safety and some very specific things, but no general regulatory authority. The actual language of the statute doesn't say that. The PUC has never asserted jurisdiction over these entities. They have long practiced that those entities, and I'm talking about the public's PUDs, municipal utilities, and rural electric co-ops, were outside their general jurisdiction. It's not like this is changing current law. What we're going to do by this is take a definition that's inadequate and ambiguous at the very least and make it clear and make it conform to everybody's current practice and current understanding. Mr. Mayor taught me something during this. There's a process in Legislative Council's office called a pink sheet. I had never heard of this. A pink sheet is where they have identified themselves an issue that they think at some point needs to be addressed. It's either bad language, ambiguous language, or whatever, and they look for an opportunity in a bill to do that. They've had a pink sheet on this very issue since 2003. So we're coming a little bit later than that, but we're coming finally to you with a solution. I want to thank the people from the cities, the League of Cities staff, their attorneys, the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, and the Oregon Public Utility District Association, as well as others, for working with us to try to find a solution. One of the reasons it's being brought to you now is that recently, in the last year or so, there was a case brought before the Public Utility Commission about a boundary dispute, who gets to serve a particular load, if I recall the underlying dispute. That happens all the time. There were three parties, an investor-owned utility, a rural electric co-op, and an independent power producer. And although this was not raised by the Public Utility Commission or the investor-owned utility, or certainly not the co-op, The independent power producer argued they should win the case because of this definitional problem. And now the PUC decided that issue, the case on a different ground, so it wasn't decided by the PUC, and we appreciate that. But whenever one of those issues, those creative arguments, gets out in the public domain, we expect some other attorney will raise it again. So that was what highlighted the issue for us, and we wanted to bring this to you for your decision. We tried this bill back in 15. People said we need more time to think about it, so we agreed to hold it off to 16 and have been working pretty continuously with people since then. So I would also like to thank publicly Mark Mayer, who spent untold hours addressing this issue with us, and we really appreciate that. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for making this, in James's behalf, for making this bill into one sentence. He'll have to read it. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Right. Mark? Talk about need and unintended consequences. Potential.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I prepared the draft. Do you have any questions about the draft that I can answer at this time?
You want to get off easy, don't you? Yeah. This law has been in effect for, what, over 100 years?
Correct.
I guess the question I have is I really don't have any issue with switching it. But what I'm concerned about is that definition and related things is sprinkled throughout the ORS. And I guess my concern, and I need some assurance, is that we're not going to triple wire someplace else unintentionally.
The Dash 1 amendments take care of that because we didn't address the problem through the base definition. What the Dash 1 amendments do is they merely specify for ORS Chapter 757, which is almost exclusively public utilities regulated by the commission, that the term public utility does not include these two types of entities. So what the Dash 1 amendments do is they confine the exclusion of the definition to these two entities to Chapter 757 alone. One of the things that I did as part of this bill drafting process is we did do a search throughout all of Oregon revised statutes, and we looked at every single mention of public utility throughout statute. I actually created a chart on behalf of another member that I could probably replicate quite easily for anybody on this panel who would like to see it, that discusses the different mentions and if they already apply to consumer-owned utilities or not. So the research has been done to maybe do a more wholesale cleanup, but you're correct. Somebody should look at all those mentions if we're to do this in a more consistent and uniform manner throughout statute and decide, you know, where do we need to be explicit about if this applies to consumer-owned utilities and where not. And I think that obviously on a short session, maybe they couldn't quite get there this session, but we've done the research as to what statutes need to be looked at, and there are quite a few of them, but there's fewer than you might think. There's about 83. So
we're not going to get into problems with poll attachments?
No. Again, the Dash 1 amendments...
Look before you dig and all of that?
There are no references to this new Section 1, so this new Section 1 will only apply to Chapter 757. You don't have to worry about the unintended consequences outside of that chapter.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mark.
All right. It wasn't that much work, Senator.
Okay. Okay, we have Paul, so Tracy. And who else? We had Beth.
Yes.
Yeah, Beth. Tracy. Oh, and there's a whole bunch up here. Ted, do you want to come up too? It can make this easy. You're all okie dokie with the agreement now.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, Tracy Rutten, League of Oregon Cities. And yes, we believe we are okie dokie for the record.
Okay.
I also want to thank Paul Cosgrove and Senator Olson and Mark Mayer for all of the time spent to really take a look at this and all of the cross-references of that definition. It was not a fun task to go through that document, but the document that was created by Legislative Council was much appreciated and made our job a lot easier, so I do appreciate that. We are supportive of the bill with the Dash 1 amendment. It is our understanding that the change will impact provisions of Chapter 757, but will not alter the definition of public utility in ORS 757-005, which is a definition that is used, as you have heard, in many other statutes and chapters of law. So we appreciate your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard, members of the committee, I'm Beth Vargas Duncan with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association, representing 11 different municipalities, cities that have electric utilities attached to them throughout Oregon, but not Eugene Water and Electric Board. I just add that for clarity. They have their independent representation. Again, we are all in agreement on the Dash 1 amendment, and we very much appreciate all the great hours and efforts by everyone aforementioned already. And Tracy already stated we had the same concerns that we had in understanding that there are no unintended consequences as a result of the change reflected in the Dash 1 amendment, and I'll just leave it there, but happy to answer questions at the proper time.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case, Executive Director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We view this as a largely technical fix that is probably long overdue, so accolades again to Senator Olson for his leadership, Paul Cosgrove, and Mr. Mayor for their work. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
I always thought it would be nice if they would have changed that, just used the terms investor-owned and consumer-owned utilities. It would have made life so much easier.
Maybe. Right. Yeah, someday.
All right. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman.
Is there anybody else who wants to testify? Okay, well, it is 2:06. So, Senator Gerard, we
need to close it and open a work session first.
We're going to close the public hearing, we'll open a work session.
A script for suspending the rules.
Oh, here we go. You got a script.
Hey, all right.
We have a work session open on Senate Bill 1547. Go ahead.
I move that the rules be suspended so that the committee may take action on the proposed amendments without first distributing and reviewing the fiscal and revenue impacts as proposed in the Dash 1 amendments. So, in short, Mr. Chair,
you want to suspend the rules?
I want to suspend the rules.
There's no debate on this motion, Mr. Chair.
There's no debate. Is there any opposition to suspending the rules? Seeing none, rules are suspended.
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Gerard.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1547.
Senator Gerard's moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1547. Discussion on that motion. Any opposition to the motion? Dash 1s are adopted. Senator Gerard.
You want it to go to the floor, right?
Yep.
I move Senate Bill 1547 move to the floor with the due pass recommended as amended by the Dash 1 amendments.
Senator Gerard has moved Senate Bill 1547 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with the due pass. Any discussion? Any opposition? It is, and I'm assuming that Senator Olson would like to carry that.
Sure.
If not, I will. All righty, so we're closed on 1547. We are now open on 1546. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1546, we did open this bill briefly when last we met on Monday. It prohibits towers from towing a motor vehicle from a parking facility without first being contacted by the owner of the facility or the owner's agent. It removes the exception from the prohibition on parking a tow vehicle near a parking facility in order to monitor the facility. It removes the notice exception for towing of motor vehicles that are in violation of certain no parking signs. It makes specified violations punishable by a maximum fine of $250. We have in hand for this measure, for the original measure, no fiscal impact and no revenue impact statements, Mr. Chair.
Senator, the other side of the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Chuck Riley, Senator for Senate District 15, which is Hillsborough, Corneas, Forest Grove, North Plains, Roy and Robert, and all the farmers in between. This bill comes about because a few years ago, Senator Gordley and I did some work on this, and got some a law passed to curtail what we then called predatory towing. It helped some, but it didn't stop the problem. And we have lots of stories. I'll give you just a couple. In an apartment building, there was a couple living in an apartment, and they had an assigned parking space for one car. The husband went to work, took the car, and the woman, who was pregnant at the time, called her mother to come over and take her to the hospital. The mother came over, parked in her daughter's parking space, went in to get her daughter ready to go to the hospital, and came out, and the car was gone. Now, the signs up said, you know, you got to have a tag. You got to. There's all kinds of things that have to be done here in order to park. And she parked in a space that belonged to her daughter, and then her car was towed. This wouldn't have happened if the requirement had been that the towing company was called to come out and make this tow. So that's one of the stories and one of the reasons why we are putting this bill forward. The bill would do two things. Basically, it would require that the before a tow can be made, the owner or the owner's agent must contact the towing company for an individual tow, not in general, and that's how a tow would be initiated. It also says that let me give you one more thing before we talk about the next thing. I have a lot of records of complaints about these towings, and one of the things that it says in several of them is I called the police and they came, and they said to me, this is a civil matter, we can't do anything. So because of that, I'm putting in this bill, making the violation of this bill a Class D violation, which carries up to a $250 fine per violation. But I want to say that because I heard testimony Monday and I've talked with a couple of people, I have an amendment that is coming. It's not here, so we can't do that amendment today. So I'm going to propose it on the House side. And that amendment would simply say that any retail business with fewer than 50 parking spaces are exempt from these new regulations, the new part of the regulations, while the business is open for business. With that, any questions?
Questions, Senator?
I do. We have actually, the chair and I were arguing over a few things.
You're going to be asked my question.
Surprise, surprise. And it is current law. What is current and what isn't? So, you know, I had a conversation with you, and mm-hmm. I told you that I think that, say, parking spaces 8, 9, and 10, mm-hmm. somebody's in them, I want them towed. The owner gives gives the towing company permission, if anybody's in those, to tow those slots. Under current law, that can be done, but under your bill, that could not be done. Is that not correct?
That's probably true. Yes.
Okay. Did I phrase that right for you?
Let me try a different
way. Yeah.
Let me ask it in a different way.
Okay.
My understanding from... you're kind of reversing thing that under your bill, a building owner could have multiple tenants, could have one, could designate an agent.
Correct.
And I assume then if he contracted with a towing company, he would inform then, you know, you're cruising my lot, you see someone who's near, they would have to contact the agent and say, there's a car here that we think we should tow. Do you want it towed?
And you can do that currently, or you could do it under the new law. It just has to be a contact before the tow is made, before they hook it up, anything happens. There has to be that contact with the owner or the owner's agent.
So, but they could designate anyone to be their representative?
Anyone other than an employee of the towing company.
Anyone other than an employee of the towing company.
Mm-hmm.
I've got another question.
Well, go ahead.
Okay, who has to make the phone call? If the towing company called the agent,
they have to be contacted by the owner or his agent. It doesn't designate who makes that phone call, but they have to be contacted before the tow. And they could call that agent and say, "Hey, we see there's a car. Do you want that towed?" And if they say yes, that's a contact. Hmm.
Question,
Senator Thompson.
So, what if they make call after call after call and nobody answers the phone?
They can't tow.
Then you can't tow.
The answer is they cannot
under
tow.
Under his proposal, then you couldn't tow.
That's correct.
You can't contact anybody.
So while that owner's on vacation and not available,
his agent
for phone
can
calls
do it.
Or
but you're missing a point. There could be an agent.
His agent.
What if the agent's on vacation?
Well, if everybody's on vacation, they can't tow.
Okay.
I mean, they've got to have someone to contact.
Other questions?
No, I'm good. I understand. I sympathize. My sister-in-law had her car towed. My wife heard about it, so therefore I heard about it. I think we're sort of on the same page of what we want. The wording is to wordsmith it so that it works for it achieves what you want, but it isn't an overriding burden for the property owner. That's where it gets a little tricky, and so I would suggest we send it down to rules, let them work on it. And that way you could get your amendment out and try to fix it there.
So, Mr. Chair, I would oppose that, but what I would like to do is get this moved today and put in the amendments in the House side because of time constraints.
Okay. I hear any other questions of the senator?
No.
Thanks.
Thank you.
No.
Okay, we have a couple other people here. Cheryl, is it Cheryl?
Yes,
here we are. Hemstra?
Hemstra.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Chair, Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Hemstra. I'm an assistant attorney general at the Oregon Department of Justice. I work in our civil enforcement division, and we do receive a lot of complaints about towing on our consumer protection hotline. It is quite an issue. We're happy to see some energy behind this issue. I know there's a big task force in 2007 that really took a good look at this, but that's been a while now. So we're excited to see some energy, and we're hoping we can work together with the stakeholders again to maybe do some work in this area. That being said, we do have some concerns with the bill as it's written. First of all, there's a Supreme Court issue. Currently, this is connected with the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. That's where it's enforced right now. The Class D violation would add enforcement, but it's currently under
the UTPA. Can you explain that? I'll just get into the Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
So it's in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act at ORS 646-608-1-DDD is the connection into this. And so there was a Supreme Court case that said the UTPA only applies when there's a consumer household or goods or services, not business to business. And so our concern here is it would be, say, you know, a 7-Eleven would have to call the tower, and those are both businesses. So that's sort of a technical issue.
Okay, I'm missing.
Okay.
Others catching this? Try that another way. Put it in lay language. What is the problem?
Okay, so the issue is it's enforced through the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the UTPA. The UTPA doesn't apply to business-to-business transactions. And we would see the call from the, say, 7-Eleven to a tower. That's business to business, right?
Okay.
So the UTPA can't enforce that is the issue.
It's a private contract.
Okay.
So that's the technical issue.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may.
So the person who's being towed is the consumer. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we might want to test this one, because I don't believe that your reading is probably going to hold up. This is not just a business-to-business transaction. There's also a consumer involved.
Right. There's a downstream consumer.
Yes.
Sorry, Chair Breyer, Senator.
Upstream
consumer. So are you getting that? I'm sorry, I didn't cut you off.
That's okay. Go ahead.
See if I understand this. So, under the current law, if there's a dispute between a tower and the consumer being towed,
right,
that falls under the UTPA.
Right.
Did I get that right? Yeah.
That's correct. Yes.
But I could see where if you changed it to where they're calling, and the business says, "Yes, tow that car," then the liability shifts to the business.
Correct.
So the tower is no longer liable for that under the prior act.
Right. So that's the technical issue, yes.
So we have conflict on that part.
Right.
Is that the piece you're worried about?
We're worried about that piece mainly. There's also the policy behind it a little bit as well. As we mentioned, you know, there was the task force in 2007, and a lot of balancing went on then between the towers and businesses and so forth. The flip side to, you know, the consumer protection side of this is having spaces available so people can patronize businesses and so forth, and we've submitted some written testimony on that issue. So.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, I led that task force.
Mm-hmm.
So I know a little bit about it, and There was some balancing that went on, and I think that was a good thing. It didn't work. Okay, that's the problem. If we tried to make something work, and we didn't go far enough because it didn't work, so we need to fix the pieces that didn't work.
So I have another one. You're changing the, I forget, was it a misdemeanor or whatever it was?
Yeah, it's a Class D misdemeanor.
Class D
violation. I'm sorry.
So how does that? So I guess that would be towing without the owner's permission. Is that where what falls into that?
A violation of any of the regulations. And yeah, I think the reason that's in there is because so many times the police are called and they can't do anything because it's not a violation. It's a civil matter.
So does DOJ have a comment on that?
Class D violation, Chair Breyer, Class D violation would be more like a speeding ticket kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
That's where that category falls into,
right.
That. So.
You could write a ticket.
So you don't have a problem with that part of the senator's bill?
I don't have a problem with that as far as I know. No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Others?
If I could add one more thing.
Go ahead. Sorry to cut you off.
That's fine. The issue with the signage, typically if a consumer has good information about cannot park here, we like to see a lot of signage that actually helps both the business and the consumer and the tower have clarity about where they can park and where they can't. So we'd prefer to see that kept in the law as is, or work with a group, you know, for 17 on what would be good ideas around signage, clarifying and so forth.
So what we did, if I may, what we did was not preclude anyone from putting up signs. What we did was preclude the appearance of signs, the signs being present, keeping that from overriding the phone call. We took the piece out that says they can tow it if there's a sign. Now, we didn't say you can't put up a sign.
Does it still require a sign?
No.
And so we'd like to see signage.
And I agree. I would like to see signage as well. I didn't intend to remove the signs, just to make it not that couldn't be the reason for the tow is because there's a sign.
Okay. Others? Okay.
Okay.
Anything else?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. And then I have Michael. Cole?
Yes.
Okay. Your handwriting is very small.
I know. Some people say I write like a doctor, so I'm sorry about that. Thank you, Chair Breyer, committee. I'm back again. I was here on Monday. My name is Michael Coe with Parking Enforcement Services. I'm probably the largest tower that deals with impound towing in Oregon. So I think I can answer a lot of questions. I don't want to repeat everything I said on Monday. I did provide some paperwork documentation for you to go through, but in light of some of the things that heard today, I'd certainly like to address a few things for clarification. We're against the bill, and not because I'm in the impound business. We're against the bill because this isn't very well thought out. And no disrespect, Senator Riley, I would like to see probably another task force work with the towing industry, because we, of course, know what it is we do. When you do something like this, it would be like going to probably a dentist office and say, okay, you can't do cleanings anymore. You can do dental work, but you can't do cleanings. And so this really impacts a private property owner. So I'm concerned about adding to a bill that already has a lot of errors. As far as the situation that Senator Riley brought up, do mistakes happen? Yes, they do. Just like laws aren't written black and white, there are gray areas. Mistakes do happen. But I think a lot of them can be worked out. Usually, when a complex, whether it be residential or commercial, contacts us, we go and assess the parking lot free of charge. We look at their situation. They tell us what the problems they're having. In a situation like that, what we would normally do is advise the complex: if you have assigned parking for certain individuals, then let them call it and remove cars from their assigned space. And we do that all the time, but people have to prove that that's their assigned space. So usually they have something from the complex saying Michael Coe is allowed to park in space number 47. And then I have rights to keep my space clear. The limit as far as the number of spaces on a property really isn't going to work. We work with Nike, Port of Portland, vacant lots that really have no space. I mean, how do you assign the number of parking spaces when there's no definition for parking spaces? Shopping centers, Intel, most colleges, certainly a lot of larger residential communities. All you need is four residential complexes, and you've exceeded that 100 parking limit. So as it is, the prior bill that came out on Chapter 98 also had a lot of errors in it that really impacted towers statewide. Expired plates is no longer something that we can tow for. Now, one of the reasons why residential communities like to tow for expired plates is because the vehicles fall in a state of disrepair, especially in older complexes. So the vehicle ends up on blocks or has a flat tire, and then people are dissuaded from living there because they think it's not a very safe community to live in. So, apartment owners or managers don't right now they usually police it during the day, and then at night they don't have anybody there. They either have to hire somebody or hire a security company. In Tualatin, Fairview, and the state of Washington, that's exactly what happened, is they had to hire security companies. That drove the rates up to the renters in every one of the communities that they barred patrol towing for. What I think you're concerned about is you're concerned about situations where the violator or the parker is not protected. And I think there's a better way to come up with an answer that protects those people. And I think you really need to work with the industry that sees all these situations and can educate you to come up with something that protects those people from fly-by-night situations, fly-by-night towers. I could go into, certainly there's a lot of situations that we tow for on vacant properties. For sale cars are put on properties, and if they're not removed, then, and the car's broken into, the liability is on the property owner because they didn't remove the vehicle. Well, they don't have the time to, or the money to, just hire a security company to patrol that all the time. So they ask us to do it as an agent. So
I hear where you're going, Michael.
Yes.
I guess I'm having a little bit of an issue. I understand the concerns you're raising, but it strikes me at a time when everybody's got one of these,
mm-hmm.
that when you have a contract with, you know, XYZ apartment complex, and they have a number that's not that big of a thing, I mean, now you're already required to call them and say, we've hooked this car up, we're going to take it.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to call beforehand and said, I'm sitting here, it looks like you got an illegal parker, do you want me to tow it?
Do you, you're the manager of the complex, do you want to be woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning? I mean,
well, if I got a problem, yeah.
Yeah. So,
but that doesn't bother me. I mean, that seems to me that as an owner, you've got a reasonable responsibility if you want to have that kind of enforcement to do that.
Well, you do, but you're taking the right away from the property manager, the person that has a responsibility over the property. They chose to go this route because we patrol the property for free. There's no cost to them.
Well, there still isn't. They just got to say, you got to call them.
Well, there
is a proposal. You call them and say, I got one.
Yeah, but there's the labor, there's the fuel, there's a $90,000 truck and time that it takes to go through those properties.
But none of that has changed. You're just making a phone call.
But meanwhile, you're going to sit in.
You're still going to, I mean, you're supposedly under the law, as I understand it now, you're still most to make the call and say, we're pulling a car.
Well, we do. We have software.
So
that
this is just before you hook it up, you call.
Well, and we already do with most municipalities, is we have to call the municipality and let them know that we're going to tow the car before we hook it up.
Municipality.
Well, this isn't,
yes.
I don't see this as an additional burden.
It's just another phone call.
Yep.
That's so we're going to sit out in the lot with a large truck at night and wake up the complex while we're calling the four or five people that we have to call.
Yep. Senator Gerard.
Well, I mean, I have rentals, and
sure.
So Senator Monroe has rentals, and we want the spots reserved for the people that are supposed to have those spots.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if somebody's say that some of them are supposed to be clear for the night. And so during the evening hours, there's not supposed to be anybody in these parking spaces. So I give you a contract to tow those people in those parking spaces that are supposed to be cleared in the evening. I sure as heck don't want to be woke up at 2 o'clock each time somebody wants to tow somebody out of those spots. And so I think it is, for big parking lots, it would be a huge burden, I would think. And then for small individuals, I just think that we can work on this, get language as he's suggesting. The bill, even according to the good senator, isn't quite the way he wants it. Send it to rules. Let us come up with something that maybe work a little better. The signage part is the one that bothers me. Because, by God, if I park somewhere, I want to see a sign that says no parking, you know, so I know,
yes.
In big black and white letters, And you will be towed after 9 o'clock.
So I'm sure you have in property, if somebody, an example, if somebody parks in front of your dumpster, it's Tuesday, the garbage truck comes by,
absolutely.
Guess what? They don't dump the garbage, but you have to call them back, and then you have to pay another fee to make a special trip to dump the garbage. Your fire lanes are blocked, and the fire trucks can't get through. The fire marshal's going to come through and fine the property $10,000.
So you didn't read the bill? It says,
I did.
Yeah.
I did, and I know that that exemption is there. But and not in every property, there are different situations. Mm-hmm. I certainly welcome anybody that wants to come down and see our operation. I can to talk to some of our people and see what problems we run into. See the lengths that we go to answer customer complaints and questions. You know, if any one of you received a complaint, then to be fair to me, I would probably need to know what it is so I could give you the other side of the story.
I mean, these are huge issues. I know in my condominium building that I have up in Portland, we changed management companies, and that was the biggest thing. They tried to get a hold on this because we had a lot of PSU and other people parking in it, and then the owners blew up over the whole thing.
Yeah.
Condo owners. It's not an easy thing to deal with. People's cars started getting towed.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, may I?
You can.
So, I've been studying this for 9 years. The bill is as written is exactly what I wanted. The amendment that I was going to do was to, you know, give something to some people that I thought, okay, that can't hurt. But the bill is exactly as I would like it to be. I think, and I have been studying this. I led the work group in 2007. I've been watching this for 9 years, and it hasn't cleaned up. And to be honest, it's not rogue towers.
Mm-hmm.
Who are making those tows. It's not mostly the small towers. It's mostly the large towers. It's out of hand and needs to be cleaned up.
In the situations where the police need to be called, I mean, that can be solved by just showing, requiring the tow company to show a copy of the contract on file from the property management company or the owner. And produce that to the officer. That was one of the things we worked on with the city of Beaverton, who was looking at towing legislation. We gave them lots of ideas on ways to solve problems that they were having. We're currently working with the OTTA on coming up with some certification and stuff like that we could do that would legitimize the people that can tow and what they can tow for and what rules and standards that they're going to adopt. So that way, when different municipalities want to do something about towing, we can steer them to the state association that can then make recommendations rather than what happened after the last go around was you had a few communities that started regulating towing, regulating prices. And one of the things that they never put in there was they never put in any kind of CPI index changes annually. So we've been begging for Gresham to give us a increase ever since, and they just tell us to pack sand. Well, our costs go up. People want to raise minimum wage. We've got cost of training, cost of equipment, fuel goes up and down. So we have to meet our obligations, but none of the municipalities will meet their obligations to correctly enforce the codes that the last bill let them create. And I'm all for that, because if we can get some standards of practices and eliminate, you know, bad policy, then I'd say do it. I don't want the reason why I have problems in Fairview and we can't tow in Fairview and Tualatin is because of one tower. And they were doing kind of a shady operation. They got chased out of the east side, so they went to the west side. Now they got chased out of there. And I don't know what they're doing now. But they changed names. So to eliminate that, I think we do need to put some standards in place. And I'm all for it. Like I said on Monday, we were the first company that started photographing all the vehicles before we towed them, showing the vehicle in violation, showing the sign, We are the first company to set standards for signage, and the Portland City Code, which supports us in our against this bill, adopted many of the things that we were doing as common standards. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Tow Truck Association. We have quarterly information meetings. We had one Saturday where we had a majority of our members, and we read this bill. And the main concern was, and if it came up today, about the signage that DOJ brought up, and I just want to ask this question for the record. Currently, a tower may tow a motor vehicle if the motor vehicle violates a prominently posted no parking sign that warns that parking is prohibited 24 hours a day. That has been deleted from the bill. So that tells me, and I'm usually wrong on these things, so bear with me, that we can no longer tow when a prominently posted no parking sign that warns that parking is prohibited 24 hours a day is posted. We are concerned about, the room was concerned about John Q. and Jane Q. not being told where they can park and where they cannot park. And then I heard today in this conversation that we can still post signs.
Correct.
But that does not say that here. That says we can't tow if the signs are posted.
That's right. That's right.
Is that the meaning of this? I'm just asking the question.
And yes, the way that the bill is written does not prohibit any signs from being posted. What it prohibits is towing simply because there's a sign posted.
Okay.
You also must have a contact with the owner or the owner's agent.
Anything
That's
else,
it. That's
gentlemen?
It. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment? Okay, come on down.
Senator Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Gwen Baldwin. I represent Multifamily Northwest, an association that represents over 175 units of housing of all types across the state of Oregon. And you should maybe just hot in your inboxes have a letter that, my apologies, I thought had been posted back on Monday. And we have spent some quality time working with Senator Riley on this issue for a while. And I think that, you know, we're trying to get to a workable place. And candidly, we thought we had with House Bill 2578 several sessions ago, which created the, you know, you must have contact with the owner or agent except for 24-hour prominently noticed signs, specifically so that you could take care of some very specific places, you know, vehicles that blocked or prevented access in emergency situations or to emergency vehicles, blocking entry to the premise, blocking unlawfully parked in spaces reserved for persons with disabilities, and that specific 24-hour prominently posted prohibition. So for the record, we have no objection to the section one that adds the at the time of tow to prior to the time of tow. I mean, it's a fair update. But that ability to monitor and enforce the parking rules where it is really prominently noticed all the time, it's not a you know, sometimes the sign's up, sometimes the sign is down situation, is really valuable. And in part to Senator Gerard's comment, the you know, 2 a.m. phone call, if you have a situation where you have a property that's in a high violation area, you know, maybe it's near a university campus, that is a lot of phone calls and contacts at night. Or conversely, if you have a situation where maybe you have a quadplex or it's a, you know, home that's been converted into a couple of apartments and you have maybe 4 or 5 parking spaces, but it's basically an independent home, there isn't an on-site. You're having to contact someone who's not there. and try to track them down and get them to comment on this area, something they haven't seen. Whereas if you have it prominently noticed with a sign 24 hours that says you can't park here, then having a company that is able to come and address that is really beneficial to the entire community. I mean, again, our business is not towing. Our business is providing quality rental housing to people. But this is a service that in its limited, restricted fashion is very useful. And we think this is a reasonable compromise to the original concerns that we completely understood about overly aggressive towing. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1546.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 1546. Is that right? Senate Bill 1546 to the Rules Committee with no recommendation.
Discussion and motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm supportive of what Senator Ryder is trying to do here.
So am I.
I agree with sending it to rules because it needs some more work, some tweaking, but I'd prefer to indicate that there's support from this committee.
Oh, I'll change mine. I'll do it with a DPAS recommendation.
Okay.
Okay. Does that make everybody happy?
Yeah.
All right. Any other comments? Just for the record, I don't see a huge... I understand the concerns, but I think there's a balancing test, and I tend to think it makes sense.
Sorry.
I agree with where Senator Riley's going. I am concerned about the UTPA issue. I think, Senator, that one needs to be explored because I think you may inadvertently be shifting a risk there.
Yeah.
The signage thing is a big deal.
I think
you inadvertently took that out, and I think that needs to be signed, but I agree with you, that should not be the sole reason why.
Right, and again, there's nothing in the bill that prohibits them from putting the sign up.
I would rather go on the other side and require it.
Please put up a sign. Okay, I'm fine with that.
Having dealt with that in different places where I pulled in, it was kind of like, can I park here or not?
I'm fine with that.
Mr. Chair.
Which I think, from your industry perspective, you probably want that too.
But Mr. Chair, we do have to be careful with that, and I think what the signs that are up now are point to ORS regulations, and we have to be very careful about the signage we put up, which says you can be towed under these regulations, and people don't know what that means, and I think we have to be very careful with that.
Well, I understand that.
Mr. Chair.
And Senator Monroe?
Yeah, additional comment. The other option would be that suggested by Senator Riley, which would be, move it through the Senate and fix it on the House side. My experience is that doesn't work real well.
Yeah. And I'm fine with it. I'm fine with this solution. I'm okay.
Okay. Senator Thompson?
Thank you.
How about if people just park where they're supposed to park?
If they would,
that would be great until they're
That's
parked in
they
your space.
if they would, we wouldn't need this law.
I know.
This is a nightmare. You got a tough business.
Yeah.
All righty. We have a motion on the floor to move Senate Bill 1546 to rules with a DPAS recommendation. Discussion, further discussion. Is there opposition? There is none. It moves unanimously. We're closed on Senate Bill 46, and we are closed for the day.
Now I have to go talk with Rosenbaum.